This is MMA Torch Supervising Editor Wade Keller with a quick introduction to this vintage audio Torch Talk that I conducted with Al Snow, a trainer for early UFC champion Dan Severn. This interview was conducted on January 2nd, 1995, just a few days after UFC's fourth event. Al Snow talks about his impression as a trainer for Dan Severn of the entire experience being at UFC. A lot of people didn't know what to expect from UFC at that point when fighters went to those events. There wasn't a lot of history to them. There was suspicion that some of the fights might be thrown. There were concerns about how the whole event was conducted. It's a fascinating behind-the-scenes look at a very early UFC event, including a funny story on Chemo's camp and other interesting tidbits from the whole experience. So hope you enjoy this. The interview lasts about 22 minutes. Just to note that this audio interview is copyright TDH Communications and MMA Torch. It is not to be reproduced or redistributed on the internet without express written permission from me, Wade Keller. We have not given permission to any other website to host this. So if you are hearing this elsewhere, please let me know at mmatorch@gmail.com so that we can notify the webmaster that our audio has been illegally redistributed. If you want to find this audio show online, just go to mmatorch.com and click on the podcast link or the audio show link. And you can also subscribe to our audio feed by doing an MMA Torch search in iTunes and subscribing to the MMA Torch podcast and livecast. All right, here we go. The January 2nd, 1994 interview with martial artists and trainer for Dan Severn, Al Snow.
Ultimate Fight Championship. Before you participated as you know, a trainer for Dan.
Yeah.
What was your impressions going in?
I believed it was a total shoot, but I was open because of, you know, cynicism from being involved in the business that
yeah.
I wouldn't put it past it being a work.
Yeah.
We trained as if it was a shoot, and, you know, we're open to the ideas that it could possibly be a work, but I have no reason to protect those people. I'm not involved in their business. I could care less about it. And I swear to God that was 100% from day one that we arrived to shoot, from all the way up to the party afterwards. I mean, it was totally a shoot the whole way.
Did anything surprise you? The fact that it was a shoot didn't surprise you. It was
no.
a confirmation, if nothing else. Was there anything about the process of being involved in it from before the show to during and after that surprised you?
I guess I was really surprised at how professionally they handled the whole thing. They were very, well organized this time. I was expecting, you know, it to be a total madhouse, but and I was also surprised at what little time it seemed like there was between matches. It seemed like, boom, we got done with one, and bam, there was, you know, calling it out for another. But, you know, other than that, there really weren't a whole lot of surprises. I pretty well knew what to expect being involved with the martial arts and stuff as far as competitions and stuff.
But, yeah.
And I figured that it would, you know, be along those same lines. And, you know, they handled things very professionally. We had on the Wednesday before the fight, we had a full fighter, trainer, manager. Everybody was there, rules and regulations meeting, so that everybody understood what was expected and what, you know, all the rules.
Yeah.
They had a professionally done press conference the next day. Where they truly, legitimately took a bingo machine and pulled balls out to set up the pairings for the next night.
Okay.
And, you know, that night, I mean, it was very, you know, it was more done, well done than, I guess, the past ones had been done. And
so there's a chance that Severn Gracie could have been the opening match.
It could have, yes, it could have very well. I mean, the thing that they did was they took Jenum and they took Gracie, and they explained it to us in the rules meeting the night before, and they had seeded them in the tournament because they said that the promotion was based around them, that they'd made all the posters up and all that, and the last thing they wanted to have happen was these two guys end up in the first round match.
Okay.
So what they did was they put Gracie in the first, you know, the first slot, and they put Jenum in the third slot, so that they, you know, already were there.
Yep.
Everybody else got their ball, with a number on it. They had a ball, matching numbers on balls and a bingo machine.
Yep.
They flicked the thing on, and then the balls started popping up. And Van Cleef's number came up first, all the other guys, and I'm sitting there thinking, you know, when each number came up, I thought, good, okay. And then when Dan's number came up last against Macias, I thought, perfect. He's last. I get to watch all the other guys fight before he does. I can sit there and tell him exactly who did what and, you know, evaluate what their strengths and weaknesses are and report back to him so he'll know what to do and, you know, we can figure out a strategy. And that's exactly what we did. I'd stand back there and I'd look was for the guy that won, what he looked like, what were some of the things to expect him to do, and so on, and
yep.
Go from there.
During the event, what was it like behind the scenes? Was everyone really kind of on their own with their own posse, so to speak?
Yeah, what they'd done was they had, the night of the event, they had set up the whole back area where everybody had their own little separate area and nobody was allowed to enter that.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably one of the most intense things I've ever done.
Really?
Yeah, we got off the plane in Tulsa and there were about, you know, Melton Bone was on the plane with us and a couple other fighters. And I mean, from the minute we got off the plane, everybody was sizing everybody else up. And I mean, everybody had their game face on. At the rules and regulations meeting, we're sitting there and I keep looking around and everybody's, you know, these three or four guys are staring at me. I'm thinking, what the hell are these guys staring at me for? They don't think I'm fighting, do they? And I get up, Dan, you know, they explain that, you know, they get these ace bandage things for the knees and elbows, and Dan says, well, get me some, and I said, okay, so I go up there, and two guys come up, hey, good luck Friday night, and I'm like, well, yeah, thanks, man. You know, I come back, I said, damn, man, these guys think I'm fighting. He said, yeah, I know, I've watched about five guys sizing you up. I said, well, great, that'll work to our advantage. Think I'm fighting, and you come walking out. And,
why did they think you and not Dan?
I think because of the way I was dressed. And plus, I was, I get pretty intense, too.
Yeah.
I would think I was just as focused as Dan, and, you know, all the fighters were there in sweatpants and warm-ups, and I was there in that, and here's Dan sitting there in a tie and a shirt.
Oh, that'll do it.
I think that's what threw them off. I think they thought that it was, you know, not because of size. I mean, I'm nowhere near Dan's size, but I think that, you know, they figured, oh, well, you know.
How worn out was Dan afterwards? You know, when you were around him? Not at all?
Not at all. You know, everybody says, you know, that he didn't have finishing moves or something. That was not the problem. He had he actually had Gracie at one point. I watched the tape. The problem was he went outside what we had planned as far as strategy.
Mm-hmm.
He started punching, and Dan's not a puncher.
Yeah.
And when he did that, every time if you watch, every time Dan punches, he comes up off of Hoist scoots up on him and into position.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, Hoist was, I go back to the old saying of, you know, who runs faster, the fox or the rabbit? Well, the rabbit, of course, because he runs for his life, and the fox just runs for his dinner.
Yep.
Hoist is that way.
Yep.
Hoist is carrying 60 years of tradition on his back.
Yep.
You know? If he loses, he's the first Gracie to lose in 60 years. Now, you know, everybody else, even Dan included, are out there to win, to show how tough they are, and for the money. And, you know, I got to give credit to Hoist. I mean, he's going to lay there on his back, tie you up, and let you do practically anything to him, which Dan did. I mean, he come close to tearing his ear off at one point. And Hoist does not open up. He just sits there and waits, and he waits, and he waits, and he waits. And, you know, Dan could not get his full weight on him, and I mean, Hoist was that good. And he had that much heart that, you know, once he's down on the ground, that's where he reigns supreme.
Do you think Dan would win 5 out of 10 fights, or more or fewer? Between if they fought once every 3 months, 10 times.
If he or Hoist won, if Dan changes his overall strategy, which is our plan.
Yeah.
Because we think we figured out some of Hoist's weaknesses because everybody has them.
Yeah.
I think he can. I think he'll beat Hoist next time.
But out of out of 10 times? Do you think once he figures him out, he could beat him 9 times out of 10? Or 10 out of 10?
I can't say that.
That's tough, yeah.
Yeah, because at the level that Hoist is at, I really, you know, you can never predict something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, all it takes is one mistake, and I think he would be able to capitalize on it. And I think Hoist is the type of competitor, and I'm truly competitor, that if he were to get beat by Dan a certain way, if Dan did not change things and try and up it again,
mm-hmm.
Hoist would figure out how he got beat and then make sure that he didn't get beat that way again.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know.
Was Dan disappointed or about the loss? Because, I mean, Jeff Blatnick. He was right away?
Yeah. He got up, and I walked in the ring, and I told him, I said, you know, it's okay. You know, you did yourself proud. And he's like, you know, I gave it to him. And he was really down.
Yeah.
But we had two goals going out there. The one, of course, was the win. And the second was to increase Dan's marketability and get him over as strong as possible and, you know, make him, you know, every chance we get to make him look, you know, verbally as good as possible.
And yeah.
I think that worked. I think it, you know, he achieved the second goal. And I mean, let's face it, he can't kick. He won $19,000. So
yeah.
That's right.
Nice work. No, it isn't. Do you think the paydays will go up given the success of these events? I mean, given what the athletes are putting on the line, doesn't $19,000 for a show that did, you know, over $1 million in pay-per-view revenue overall, does that seem like Dan might even expect more next time for a second-place finish? Or even more than 60 for a first-place finish?
I think it wouldn't be unreasonable, but,
yeah.
I mean, let's face facts. I mean, even in the wrestling business, I mean, who makes all the money? You know, the promoters and you. And if you think that you're going to get paid what you're truly worth in this business,
yeah.
You're in the wrong business.
Yeah.
Because it's just not going to happen. And I think that's going to be the case with that. I don't think, no matter how much money they make, you know, it's like, I talked to Al Costello once, and Al Costello told me, and I never understood it at the time, but it's crystal clear now. He went and he worked in India,
yeah.
And he said that they drew over 100,000 people, which, you know, I'm sure it may be true. I've heard of stories of that happening.
That, yeah, they, everyone, yep.
He got paid $10,000. He's saying, you know, Al, they fucked me. They didn't pay me without, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, you know, you're crazy. $10,000, man,
one match.
I've been doing backflips.
Yep.
But then I came to realize that, you know, if they drew 100,000 people, he's right. They
yep.
did. I mean, you know,
yep.
you know, of course. But of course, you know, you're never really going to truly get paid what it is that you deserve.
Yeah.
And that's just the business. And the sooner that people realize that, the better off. I mean, of course, you're going to want to get what you want, you know, for being fair. And
yeah.
That's reasonable. But, and you're going to try and get as much as you can. But when it really comes right down to it, I mean, Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant, when they drew 90-some thousand people at the Silver Dome and, you know, big pay-per-view dollars, even they didn't get paid what they truly
yep.
deserved.
Yep.
You know, if you come right down to it, that if it wasn't for them, they wouldn't have been there.
Yeah.
They should have gotten, you know, 60% of the house or something. I mean, they obviously didn't get that much.
Yeah. Is formatically, from being involved in martial arts in the past, is there anything that you would change about the Ultimate Fight format that, besides, you know, the idea that they're going to have Gracie in a singles match next time and then the tournament under it?
Yeah, I don't like that.
Yeah.
I think that Gracie should, you know, stay in the original format that they have.
Yeah.
Because people want to see that. The whole thing now behind the Ultimate Fight is driving forces to see Gracie lose.
Right.
And you know, the more chances that people get to see him possibly lose, the better. And I think it'll help them as far as the buy rate. But to put him in one match, I think that the first light that's going to go off in people's minds is, oh, it's obviously worked because now they're protecting him.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, I mean, Horry and his brother is Art Davies' partner. In the last, you know, that's going to, it's going to look, it's going to stink, it's going to smell. Even though really, truly, I know what they're trying to say, well, you know, that he's the reason people are buying, so let's make sure that, you know, he's the last person they see.
And there's one match that we can market.
That's right.
Yeah.
But that's the last thing they want to do because,
yeah.
you know, and, you know, get involved in the earlier fights and things like that, I think they're going to run into a lot of trouble with that. I think that's going to backfire against them. But the overall tournament, I think, is you know, the ideal behind the rules. You know, the only thing that's not allowed are biting and eye gouging, and they won't stop a match for that. They'll simply fine the person who does it $1,000.
Yeah.
I think that's good. I don't see a problem with it.
Is there an advantage for Gracie based on the way the ring is set up?
No.
With the walls there? Because I had read in a martial arts magazine an article that said that Gracie's style would not do as well on a platform without walls, uh-huh. in which you had, like, basically kind of a wrestling mat, in a sense, uh-huh. where there was the wrestling ring on a mat, and if you exited the ring, you got lost points or whatever. But that way Gracie couldn't back himself up against a wall and take an advantage or whatever.
No.
Yeah.
No.
That's pretty versatile from it, you see.
Yeah, I think so, because Gracie's whole strategy is to get a person down on the ground. He
doesn't
necessarily try to get them up into a cage, up against the wall. He does to limit their maneuverability.
Yes, yeah.
You know, to where they only have one access out, and then that enables him to make it easier for him to take them down. From what I've seen, that's really the basic use he makes of the walls. He does use the walls if somebody puts him up against there for leverage, but his basic forte is to put people on the mat and keep them there. And the walls are simply to, you know, corner somebody. And if you start getting into, well, if they go past a certain point, they lose points and things, I think you're taking away from, you know, the no-holds-barred type of aspect that they're trying to get across.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I think that would take something away from it. But I wasn't sure if that actually would hurt Gracie, given his style.
I really don't. I don't, you know, from what I've seen, I've not seen him strategically use those walls to his advantage, except for when he's up against them, using them for leverage.
Did you see Gracie behind the scenes?
Yeah.
What is his demeanor behind the scenes compared to the just, you know, vast, almost vacuous intensity that you see when he approaches and wrestles? Really?
All the way up to the fight, and then afterwards he was, you know, a nice guy. He was smiling and, you know, very quiet, very reserved, but prior to
he didn't get drunk and pinch a bunch of women in the ass.
No, didn't see him except for at the public functions that all the fighters had to be at.
Yeah.
That was the only time that he was seen, and at that time he was very focused and, you know, never looked at anybody directly. You know, he just did what he was supposed to do, which, you know, what was called for, and, you know, would set in a certain place and look straight ahead. And, you know, he did not bother sizing anybody up or anything, because he's got his family there to do that. And they were. I mean, they were, you know, taking notes on everything. You know.
Yeah.
So, otherwise, you know, he was very quiet. All the guys were very respectful, you know, of each other. Van Cleef, outside of the wrestling business, has probably got one of the most classiest people I've ever met. And the reason I say that is because most of those older wrestlers I've ever met are some of the classiest people, regardless of politicians. I've dealt with politicians. I've dealt with, you know, executives, and the classiest people I have ever met have been a lot of the old-timer wrestlers. And, you know, and by classy, not looking down upon you, they come across as, you know, feeling obviously secure about themselves and not having to prove nothing to you or anybody else, and so they don't talk down to you or, you know, act to you as if they're above you.
Yeah.
Very classy, and almost all the fighters were like that, except for Melton Dillon, the boxer. It was really pretty,
really?
Yeah. Yeah.
What was, did you run into Chemo or Chemo's trainer?
Yeah, Ron and Chemo.
Yeah.
They kept pretty much to themselves, too. They were a bit of an enigma before the fight. I know that the office girls were complaining because you had to see their room service tab because they ate constantly. I'd even seen them bring food in for Joe San, who was eating right before the fight.
Oh, God.
And, you know, that kind of bothered me because I didn't know what Joe San dough was, which obviously it wasn't shit.
Yeah. yep.
But they were kind of, you know, Chemo seems to be the guy who truly has belief in God and all that. And Joe San seems like, you know, we believe in God because Chemo does.
Okay.
Type of thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're a believer because Chemo's a believer. And, you know, Chemo's kind of our meal ticket. So,
yeah.
You know, whatever Chemo says, we do.
what do you...
Go ahead. Seems like a really decent, down-to-earth guy, but he's... kind of leaves things a little too much up to Joe San, I think. So.
What do you think of the showmanship on the ring entrances?
You know, as far as Chemo's concerned, I think it was truly an expression of his beliefs and that he was using it as a vehicle to get those across.
Yeah, okay.
As far as Joe San's concerned, I think that he was doing it as a gimmick.
I think
that it was showmanship on his part.
Interesting.
Nothing against Joe San, but
that's
the impression that I get.
Yeah. All right.
And they were pretty funny. When Hackney was fighting Gracie, they're back there watching the monitor, and they're like, you know, oh, praise the Lord, all the spirits in the house, he's with Hackney, oh, kill him, kill him.
Yeah.
Oh, praise Jesus, hallelujah. And
just almost making light of their seriousness in a sense.
No, they were dead serious.
They were dead serious.
Oh, they were dead serious.
Oh, that is, then you're, they're funny not intentionally.
Not intentionally. They were, you know, they're sitting there, you know, doing the gimmick without even realizing they're doing the gimmick.
And, wow.
And that was really funny. And I didn't see it at the time. I didn't know it had happened. But when the guy, that idiot that was interviewing him, I don't even watch the interview. I watch him because he gets so disgusted. And, you know, he was so inept. And,
yep, oh, I know. Man, well, you had the line of the night.
I didn't even know if anybody heard it. I didn't
mean
to.
Well, I mean, it was just so genuine. I mean, it's like, you know, he just kept pushing the question, and finally you're just like, hey, what do you think he's going to go do?
Yeah, I just thought it was a stupid question. What do you think?
Well, he's going to go watch Forrest Gump, you know,
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, he's going to go back there, and he's going to run himself till he's mentally and physically exhausted. It bothered me because I'm standing there, and, you know, he says, well, I'm sure you've looked into Hoist, you know, into Gracie Jiu-Jitsu and this and that. No, we hadn't. We didn't even bother. You know, and I'm thinking, you know, from a wrestling viewpoint, I'm thinking, look, you know, the guy's good, but let's not spend the whole 2 hours putting the son of a bitch over. Okay?
Right.
I mean,
then it does seem phony.
Yeah, you're giving him the push, you're pushing him, for God's sakes, guys. Let him stand on his own merits, okay?
Yep.
Don't do this like it's a wrestling show.
Yep.
And that bothered me. Then when, I didn't want to talk over Dan, but then when Dan's standing there and the guy asked him a stupid question like that, and Dan's going, you know, I just thought, man, you know, what do you think he's going to do? He's going to go back to that step.
Yeah, you got to play good cop, bad cop.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, and I didn't think anybody heard it because he pulled the microphone away from me and gave me a real disgusting look.
Yep.
I thought, well, nobody heard that, and then everybody that's called me since says, hey,